Davine's confrontation in the Sea of Oman. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stopping U.S. forces from stealing Iranian crude oil. A Republican winning the race for governor in the U.S. state of Virginia and a setback for President Biden out of next year's congressional elections. And also in our headlines, Russia still struggling to contain the spiraling COVID infections. The country records its highest fatalities in a single day. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Iran says it has blocked U.S. forces from stealing a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps will soon be releasing footage of the incident. The U.S. forces attempted to seize a tanker that was carrying Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman, but the IRGC's naval forces proceeded to guard the tanker carrying out a heliborne operation and steered the vessel toward Iran's territorial waters. The U.S. forces then started chasing the tanker using helicopters and warships, but all their attempts to block the tanker's path or seize it failed. Oil Minister Javad Oji has thanked the IRGC for securing the Iranian shipment. He said the latest incident will strengthen the Iranian government's will to overcome enemy restrictions. Elsewhere, multiple elections have been held in the United States with Republican candidates taking the lead in the gubernatorial race in some key states. The Republican wins signal trouble for Joe Biden's presidency ahead of next year's midterm elections, especially in light of his growing unpopularity.
November 2nd was a landmark day in U.S. politics. Several elections were held, including the race for governor in Virginia and New Jersey, and mayoral polls in cities like New York, Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin has garnered enough votes to win the battle against his Democratic rival Terry McAuliffe. To win over voters during a campaign speech in Chantilly, Youngkin said he will work to improve the living standards of his fellow citizens, a promise that would strike a chord with many people.
We are going to keep our communities safe. We're going to comprehensively fund law enforcement because they stand up for us, and we are going to stand up for them.
Another Republican victory was registered in New Jersey, where Jack Citarelli took a lead over incumbent Democratic rival Governor Phil Murphy. Mayoral races were also held in several cities, including New York City. There, Eric Adams, a Democrat, managed to win the highly contested vote. Virginia's gubernatorial race is traditionally viewed as a crucial barometer of the president's national standing. That takes on added importance against the backdrop of the latest polls indicating a drop in Biden's approval rating, the lowest level of his presidency. The president's loss of support, driven by his much-criticized messy pullout from Afghanistan and the Americans' economic concerns, is seen by many as the cause of the Republican resurgence in these elections.
Let's take a look at what's been happening. We've had failures in Afghanistan when there was an attack where several service members were killed. We still have an economy that's still not up and running the way that people would like. We have issues when it comes to his infrastructure bill. Pieces of the infrastructure bill keep getting taken out. And a lot of people are wondering what is going on with the promises coming from the Biden administration.
With Republicans winning in Virginia and New Jersey, the control of Congress and the fate of President Biden's agenda will be at stake. Many see the GOP wins in the gubernatorial race as not only a loss for Biden, but also a blow to the whole Democratic Party and the run-up to the next year's midterm vote.
So the fact that Youngkin will be the governor, likely the governor of Virginia, won over so many independent voters is mind-blowing. But in a lot of ways, it's also not, because Biden has failed. The Democrats have failed the people of Virginia, what's called the Rust Belt. And so they're looking for an alternative. I don't believe that the Republicans are the proper alternative. But it's still expressing the will of the people that they're not satisfied with the Democrats.
The United States has been grappling with a whole host of issues, including economy ahead of education, taxes, and the COVID pandemic. Racial injustice and rising consumer prices are among other public concerns. What would the failure of the Biden administration to address those issues it is highly likely that the 2024 presidential race will be a tight one.
We're going to go back to our previous story for this half hour, as Iran says it has blocked U.S. forces from stealing a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Writer and political analyst John White is joining us now on the line from Edinburgh. Mr. White, give us your thoughts on the incident, and what are the motives behind such an attempt by Washington?
I think this is definitely geared towards the resumption of the nuclear deal talks with the view to try to resurrect the JCPOA that was negotiated by the Obama administration when Joe Biden was vice president, and was unceremoniously destroyed by the Trump administration when it unilaterally pulled out of the deal and then introduced stringent sanctions against Iran on a policy known as maximum pressure. It seems like that policy did not die with the Trump administration's departure from the White House. It seems the Biden administration is following that policy, maybe hoping to weaken Iran's negotiating position at these talks that are set to resume at the end of November. But it's a very reckless gamble. It's a very reckless move. It's an act of international brigandage, and all right-thinking people and governments should certainly have something to say about this. This is a violation of international law. It's a violation of Iran's sovereignty, and it's an act of war, pure and simple.
And Mr. White, who benefits from such acts of destabilization and meddling in the Persian Gulf region and in the, looking at further, in the Middle East region altogether?
Well, clearly the Israelis have been lobbying fiercely the Biden administration over its attempt to resurrect the Iran nuclear deal, and also the Saudis will benefit from this because they will keep Iran's oil off the market. But the problem that they have is that the Biden administration is weak at home right now. That's the problem that the Iran and all the other participants in the talks have. And the Biden administration is looking to shore up its failing polling in the U.S. So perhaps it thinks it can wield a strong hand against Iran as an external enemy with a clear attempt to try and increase popularity at home. You know, the market of fear always demands monsters, and this is what the Americans are doing. I do fear for the future of the Iran nuclear deal. The fact that the Biden administration is not sitting down directly with Iran and is negotiating through European intermediaries, that gives me great cause for concern. It's time, I think, for Iran to start looking at other options and see the Iran nuclear deal for what it is, dead and buried.
We have to focus on the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Yeah. That's the policy they've been following for a couple of years now. When we see such outlandish measures like the one we saw in the Sea of Oman, we have to believe that maybe even the United States thinks that the maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. Unpack that for us, please.
Well, you're talking about the sanctions. Of course, the Iranians are not going to bow. That's their pride in the eyes of Washington and its allies. And so they may be trying other tactics. They're upping the ante, so to speak, and they're going for a military option to try and roll back Iran's growing influence in the region and less reliance on U.S. largesse, again at the behest of the Israeli government and its Saudi counterpart, with regional ambitions in mind. But the Iranians will not be minded to back down, certainly not this new government will not. And so it's going to be very, very, very interesting to see what happens. Very dangerous time, very reckless, but the Iranians probably have no other option other than to resist these acts of aggression.
All right, thanks a lot, writer and political analyst John White, joining us on the line from Edinburgh. Elsewhere, Palestinian families are turning down an Israeli proposed deal on their homes in a neighborhood in Al-Quds, saying the offer is only meant to justify occupation at their expense.
We rejected the compromise offered to us by the court of the occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settlers' organization and which will lead to the confiscation of our right in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country, despite that we're not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
Israel has for months been seeking to evict four Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and give their land to settlers. The families say the deal is unjust because it's meant to force them into recognizing the settlers' ownership of their lands. Hamas says rejecting the deal is the right decision to make, and that by doing so, these families are avoiding the political trap set by Israel. Hamas is asking all Palestinians to support them. Israel's Supreme Court has proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years in exchange for rent. They were given until November the 2nd to make their decision. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli decision to evict Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah will likely ignite new clashes between local residents and the Israeli settlers. Listen.
They are now urging the international community to intervene. They are saying that the Palestinians across the occupied territories in Al-Quds should stand with them, and this is what's going on. Palestinians are saying that the Israeli court's decision is illegal, and they support the Palestinian families, and they will continue to protect them to remain in their homes. But the fear is now that this refusal, the family's refusal of the Israeli decision, might cause the clashes between other settlers living in illegally living in their homes inside the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. But up to the moment, the Palestinian families made their decision clear. They will not leave their homes, and they will not accept the Israeli court's decision to pay rent for settler groups for 15 years, because after 15 years, this means that they will be forced to leave their homes, and that the Israeli regime will confiscate the land and the homes and bring settlers to illegally live instead of them.
Elsewhere, it's been 104 years since British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his infamous declaration giving Israeli settlers the permission to usurp Palestinian land. Asher Shannon has more in this following report.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for their pain and suffering for more than seven decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With the Israeli military targeting the Damascus countryside with a second missile strike in just a few days, the airstrike was launched from the northern parts of the occupied Palestine early Wednesday. Syrian media are quoting military sources as saying that the strike targeted a post in the Zakia neighborhood near Damascus. The attack has caused some material damage. No word on possible casualties. Just days ago, Syrian air defenses intercepted Israeli surface-to-surface missiles over the same area. Two soldiers were injured In that attack, Israel frequently launches missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has been demanding action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military sites as well as resistance fighters battling terrorists. The UN rights chief is concerned about the extreme brutality of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region, warning of, quote, possible crimes against humanity by all sides.
We have reasonable grounds to believe that during this period, all parties to the Tigray conflict have committed violations of international human rights, humanitarian, and refugee law. Some of these may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Russia's daily COVID toll hitting another record high as the new wave of the pandemic seems to be nowhere near subsiding. Nearly 1,200 people losing their lives to the virus in the past 24 hours. That's the 15th consecutive day the country is seeing over 1,000 fatalities. The total tally is now above 242,000. There have also been over 40,000 daily infections. The overall caseload is above 8.6 million. Russian officials are struggling to contain the surge, reimposing a partial lockdown nationwide. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech Republic is recording its highest daily infection since March, with around 10,000 cases. Also, Poland's daily cases topped 10,000 for the first time since April. Well, that's a wrap for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The UK is one of the principal states fueling the war in Yemen by providing arms to the Saudi-led coalition. Dear listeners, we have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy Ryder. This article is published under the heading Weapons Trade with Saudis and Israeli Regime Must Be Disrupted. Stay tuned for more. Earlier this month, the UN Human Rights Council voted to reject a resolution extending an independent expert review of the human rights situation in Yemen by another 2 years. The resolution proposed by the Netherlands was the first to be defeated in the Council's 15 years of existence. It was supported by the principal Western suppliers of weapons to the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen, but it seems not with the same vigor as it was opposed by Saudi Arabia. The Reuters news agency called it a defeat for Western states on the Council, though many of those same states will continue to profit from the war their arms are fueling in Yemen. Media outlets blamed the dashed resolution on intensive lobbying by Saudi Arabia and its proxy Bahrain, a voting member of the Council. UN member states have given a green light to warring parties to continue their campaign of death and destruction in Yemen. Radia Al-Mutawakkil, a representative of the Yemeni group M. Watana for Human Rights, told media. The UK is one of the principal states fueling the war in Yemen by providing arms to the Saudi-led coalition. The London government voted in favor of extending the mandate of the international experts investigating suspected war crimes in Yemen, some of it perpetrated with British-supplied arms. Put simply, the UK supports examining grave human rights abuses in Yemen while it provides the weapons, which it knows will be used to commit war crimes. Britain certainly has not listened to the recommendations of the experts to stop fueling the conflict by halting arms transfers. The UK is second only to the US in supplying arms to the Saudi-led coalition. Fragments of US-made weapons have been found in almost all air strikes investigated by human rights activists. In one report by the Yemeni human rights group, M. Batana, it was stated that U.S.-made weapons had been used in 25 out of 27 Saudi airstrikes identified. Every one of those airstrikes targeted civilians in Yemen. The third main supplier of weapons to the coalition is France, which, like the U.K., voted in favor of the renewing of the U.N. Independent Experts' mandate. The strategy underpinning Saudi tactics is the same used by the Zionist regime to foment regime change in Gaza, with the blessing of Washington, Brussels, and the political wing of the United Nations. The Saudis and Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, Yemen's president in exile, seem to believe that if they force those living under the Ansarullah rule to suffer, they will overthrow the rulers, the authors of the Brookings Institution article on Yemen claim. Yet this same strategy has failed for the past 15 years of the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, 40 years of U.S. sanctions on Iran, and 60 years of U.S. sanctions on Cuba. Though the U.S. economic warfare has failed to yield the desired regime change results, this strategy has caused great harm to average people living in those states, to say the least, as has the Zionist regime siege on Gaza. The world's top 11 arms exporters have all transferred weapons to parties to the Yemeni war. In addition to the US, UK, and France, substantial suppliers include Germany, Spain, Italy, and the Netherlands. The Zionist regime and Ukraine have also provided arms supplies, according to a report by Sam Perlow Freeman, published by the World Peace Foundation covering 2009 to 2018. Roger Carr from BAE Systems said in 2019, "Civilians are killed in war. The solution is to stop wars at the earliest opportunity. And our belief is that if you supply first-class equipment, you are the encouragement, particularly when used in defense, for people to stop fighting. That has certainly not been the case in Yemen. Not only have these arms transfers fueled conflict, but they also violate the laws of many of the states exporting them. The US, UK, and France have arms export rules to prevent the transfer of arms that might worsen conflict or be used for human rights or international humanitarian law violations, as observed in the World Peace Foundation report. Those rules have failed to prevent those states from exporting arms to parties that created the world's worst humanitarian crisis. As the World Peace Foundation report states, there is frequently a gap between many states' willingness to commit to strong arms export controls and a willingness to restrict their arms exports in practice. Instead, states' defense, foreign policy, and military-industrial interests take center stage. That deference to national interest at the expense of justice is evident in the failure to censure or sanction Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince and Minister of Defense, who bears principal responsibility for his country's actions in Yemen. The White House's National Security Advisor recently courted bin Salman to advance Saudi normalization with the Zionist regime, despite Biden's campaign pledge to make a pariah out of the Crown Prince over his role in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. In contrast, the UN Security Council has imposed sanctions on Ansarullah movement. The Netherlands voted to ban arms exports to Saudi Arabia in 2016, but Dutch banks continue to invest in weapons makers supplying the conflict, and its major pension funds finance human rights violations in Yemen and beyond. Ending arms sales is the single most effective step the US and UK can take towards ending the war, as Perlo Freeman observed in the New Internationalist earlier this year. Without the support of the U.S. and U.K. arms manufacturers, the Saudi Air Force would be grounded in a matter of days, as a former BAE Systems employee has said. Yet, world powers carry on with arms deals as usual while gesturing towards a rules-based international order to which they pay little more than lip service. So why do these states even bother to international human rights bodies? Making a pretense of caring about human rights is necessary to functioning of a system actually intended to impose imperial will. And so, Western countries vote in favor of toothless probes into rights violations in Yemen and Gaza, while lavishing weapons on Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, and providing support to maintain their advanced weapons systems. So long as there is profit to be reaped, neither the emergence of conflict nor 30 states' domestic laws will do much to restrain weapons transfers. Earnest appeals by independent investigators to the non-existent morality of weapons exporting UN member states is sadly hardly more effective. This is not to say that their work is not necessary and should not be supported. Their reportage informs the advocacy work of those genuinely concerned with human rights and willing to put their bodies on the line to defend them. Activists carrying out direct actions to disrupt the arms trade have punctured their vacuum of accountability by imposing a cost, even if it is just in terms of public image, on heightening the complicity of corporations profiting from the bloodshed in Yemen and Gaza. Divestment campaigns may also advance public consciousness and build international solidarity with peoples resisting regimes supported by Western liberal regimes.
It is where we relax, where important events take place. It is what every household in Iran has quite a few of. It is where life happens and what is passed down from generation to generation. It is in just about every country and is a symbol of cultural pride, reputation, and fine art. You guessed it. It is the exquisite Persian rug.
Hello again, I'm Samson Seas, and in this segment of Bazaar, we will explore the Iranian carpet industry and how it has adapted to the challenges posed by sanctions and fast-paced modern trends and its related trades, including innovations in manufacturing and how the general love of this magnificent rug has renovated Iran's rug production both nationally and internationally. Iran managed to stay away from the race to the bottom in the international competition. Other international competitors such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey and even India have lowered quality standards in production in an effort to reduce prices, hoping to increase their international trade. However, Iran's carpet industry has maintained the integrity of its carpet industry while adjusting to modern demands and economic struggles.
We all know that our modern times involve a lot of technology. This is also true when it comes to the carpet industry. New technology and development of fine machinery have allowed the carpet industry in Iran to produce high-quality carpets. These machines are so advanced that these carpets can resemble the quality and features of a hand-woven carpet. Plus, it takes a fraction of the time required to weave a carpet by hand. In short, speed of quality in production has been the winning card that is controlled by new technology. In order to gain a deeper understanding of the current manufacturing, machinery, and techniques, we visited Almas Kavir Carpets, an expansive carpet manufacturing facility. With a well-established reputation, this company began operating in 2007 in Kerman province. Located approximately 25 kilometers outside of the city of Kerman, Almas Kavir Carpets, with its contemporary technology and world-class certifications, is a well-recognized name all over Iran. While hand-woven carpets are still highly prized and holds a large portion of Iranian exports in the world market, the machine-woven carpet is now emerging as a close contender. Machine-woven carpets are appealingly ideal in terms of their price and large variety in patterns. You don't have to be an art collector just to appreciate an Iranian carpet. The distinctive feature that most carpet enthusiasts have an eye for is the number of knots in the width of the carpet. Just like pixels on an LCD display, when there are more pixels, you get a sharper image with more details. In other words, in terms of carpets, the more knots there are in a square centimeter of a carpet, the denser the carpet, and the more it will resemble a hand-woven carpet in terms of intricacy of pattern. These carpets are produced with the most modern technology, which can create denser carpets. Using this equipment offers the possibility of elaborate designs and intricate details to please the customer's ever-changing tastes. This production characteristic is one that Almas Kavir has a large ability to produce without compromising the quality of the carpet. Carpets with such elaborate detail are highly prized, and of course you would understand why when you see the soothing patterns with spectacular colors and definition. It is exciting to see how this company has managed to stay true to the ancient roots of Iranian carpet weaving. It offers diverse range of patterns, both modern designs as well as traditional Kerman patterns, in large variety.
On this note, in a broader scale, Iran has the technological capacity to annually produce over 120 million square meters of machine-woven carpets. Iran has over 1,300 carpet manufacturing facilities across the country. The machine-powered carpet industry has been operating for over half a century. One way it has maintained its integrity is by adhering to national and global standards and respecting the ancient art of carpet weaving. So it is no surprise to see how resilient this industry has remained. Uses of domestically produced thread such as acrylic, polyester, with weaving and loom machines imported from Belgium and Germany, procured from internationally recognized brands. The Iranian machine-made carpet is considered the most expensive textile production in the world in terms of design, quality, and color. It continues to use high-quality raw materials and processes of making both hand-woven and machine-woven carpets. The key to most of these sales have been the exhibitions. Whether you are an art connoisseur or a lover of beautiful objects, the desire to own a Persian carpet has been a driving force in the national and international market.
Almaz Kadir has had its sights set on increasing international exports. However, because of the decline in the Iranian economy in recent years, more and more customers are turning towards machine-made carpets as the prices are more affordable. This is a bonus for Almaz Kadir Carpets, as it supports national growth. Such results have led to a production boom in the carpet industry. Increase in manufacturing brought sustainability and self-sufficiency of a production that is not only focused on exports. Internal growth within the borders of Iran would mean supporting export increases. According to statistics from Iran Textile Association, machine-made carpet exports account for over 50% of Iran's total textile fabric exports, with a value of over $750 million. Holding a global share of 30%, carpets are the second largest export of Iran, the first being energy-producing materials and mining. The US ban on import of Iranian carpets in September 2010 truly did a number on the Iranian carpet industry. It is interesting to know that America was the biggest importer of Persian rugs for years leading up to the 2010 sanctions. The results were a large decline in carpet exports. However, in 2017 to 2019, Iran enjoyed a magnificent comeback and a large increase in carpet exports. Innovation in production has been one of the pillars of speed. For Almaz Kadir, it began with quality. So, as the carpet industry turns its gaze towards the domestic market, it has sought to woo customers with larger varieties, colors, designs, and modern patterns, consequently bringing more revenue, resulting in exponential growth of this industry. This expansion also helped bolster related markets and sectors, such as the thread spinning industry. One such discipline you might be surprised to know about that frequently utilizes the services of this company is the architecture community. With the fast pace of modernity, you might have noticed that individualized tastes have become paramount. Almaz Kadir has adapted to these demands with its R&D department running on all six cylinders. With a long-standing reputation of honoring the art of Kerman's carpets, it prides itself in its progressive steps towards discovering new products to offer. With this industrial boom comes job security and opportunity. Many employees have left the hand-weaving carpet industry owing to low wages and arduous labor. Hand-woven carpets can take up to 5 years to complete. Most of the expenses for the production of these carpets goes to the raw materials, such as finely hand-woven silks and wools. Not much is left for the weavers themselves. Remarkably, weavers' salaries in Iran are relatively high in comparison to other countries with hand-woven carpet exports, where the labourers are often exceptionally underpaid in order to reduce production costs and product end prices. So, treading this fine line carefully is crucial. As Almas Kabir Carpets imports its own highly specialised machines for weaving, it has also provided for more job opportunities, such as machine maintenance, transportations, and other technology support, such as IT. With less arduous labor for weaving, it has reduced some of its expenses. Consequently, this manufacturer is able to offer steady salary and benefits to its employees without the hard labor, while also creating more business opportunities. On a larger scale, the shift towards industrialization of local crafts, such as thread spinning for textile production, also offers prospects for growth and technological development for sustaining the production of goods necessary to meet market demands.
The Association of Iran Textiles Industries has announced that Iran is self-sufficient in producing polyester raw materials, as nearly all of the domestic demand for this material is met by Shahid Tongoyan Petrochemical Company, with an annual output of more than 350,000 tons. The textile sector has vast untapped potential in this field, which is already well equipped with quality raw materials. What this sector lacks is advanced production machinery. Currently, one of Iran's smaller exports is polyester yarn. However, with the high market demand of machine-woven carpets, this industry is experiencing an industrial expansion with a highly lucrative outlook.
While the sanctions imposed on Iran have provided chances for internal development in this industry, Iran has been deprived of the large growing international market. Notwithstanding the economic embargoes, Iran's carpet sector has continued to be prosperous. Iran has exported $123 million worth of machine-woven carpets from Kashan alone in the last 6 months of this year. The sanctions have also touched Almas Kabir Carpets, and they are faced with resolving these challenges. According to statistics released by the Textile Association, Turkey makes close to $2 billion every year from the export of machine-made carpets, whereas Iran's share reaches barely $300 million.
The Textile Specialist Association put the volume of machine-made carpet produced in the country in the past Iranian calendar year, ended March 20th, 2019, at 90 million square meters, about 60 million square meters of which hit the domestic market. I was happy to discover that the country enjoys a high capacity of producing up to 120 million square meters of machine-made carpet per annum. It is possible, granted appropriate export markets are taken into consideration for this product. Another delightful statistic is that Iran possesses high capability of exporting machine-made carpets up by $1.5 billion annually. Iran's carpet industry has brought much profit from its exports. However, the biggest exports besides oil in Iran have been mining minerals and ores. Despite harsh economic sanctions, I was happy to find out that Iran was ranked 10th in the steel production industry by the World Steel Association. Iran's steel output has been 30 million tons this year, according to the Financial Tribune, with a 9% growth. And we're not finished yet. In our feature program, we'll be accompanying Amir Mehdi Kazemi on his journey to central Iran, majestic landscape of Yazd province, to visit Abarku City, where the Sarmad Abarku Iron and Steel Company is located. This mighty company mines iron and steel around the clock. It has the capacity of production of 600 million metric tons of steel.
A relation which has continued for generations with the aim of creating wealth and welfare.
A group of workers work round the clock near the central Iranian city of Abarku in Yazd province to turn melting steel into high-quality rebars. One of the most demanded construction materials in Iran and in neighboring countries. The Sarmat Abarkuh Iron and Steel Company is one of Iran's latest steel complexes, which began its first operational phase in 2015 by launching a rebar production line using the latest European technologies and standards. The vision of the company, according to its founders, is increasing the capacity of Iran's steel industry in order to boost the economy and create jobs for the educated young population in the region. All the necessary infrastructures, including water, electricity, and gas, have been provided for the expansion of the complex in the future. The factory is only 500 meters away from the railway, which gives it an extra logistical advantage. Iran's steel production in 2018 reached a total of 25 million metric tons. Sarmat Abarkuh Iron and Steel Company currently produces more than 450,000 metric tons of rebars. The amount is expected to double after the second rolling mill is built next to the current plant. The company says it welcomes investors for its upcoming projects. Covering an area of 150 hectares, the complex will be home to other facilities, including a steelmaking unit, a steel ingot production factory with a capacity of 600 million metric tons, and an electric arc furnace, which will turn it into a huge steel production complex. The National Standard Organization of Iran has issued two strict indexes for rebars used in the country's construction industry. First is the appearance of the rebar, which deals with its size and dimensions. And second are the mechanical features of the product that have to do with safety and strength. Observing strictest international quality standards becomes a must, especially when you're manufacturing a strategic product with clients at the national and international level. Here at Sarmat Laboratories, the most sophisticated demonstrations are routinely conducted on samples in order to make sure that the rebars which leave the production line are qualified enough in order to be consumed in all international markets, including in Europe. According to experts at the test lab, product benchmarks exceed national standard. Environmental aspects are also taken into consideration. The water consumed at the factory is provided by a water purification or reverse osmosis unit. R&D efforts are also underway to manufacture some of the equipment of the production line. This will diminish the company's dependence on imported spare parts at a time when U.S. sanctions on Iran's banking sector makes it difficult for Iranian industries to make foreign purchases. International figures show a considerable growth in Iran's steel output and exports since 2009. In 2018, steel exports formed about 8% of the entire export value. Iran's vision is to reach a total annual production of 50 million metric tons of steel. To fulfill that objective, foreign financing is highly required. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Bazaar.
Well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Stay tuned with us for other market-packed episodes of Bazaar. Check us out on social media by visiting our Facebook or Instagram pages. We would love to hear from you. So leave us a comment or send us a message. You can also email us with other questions or topics that you would like us to explore. Until next time. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.